Welcome to another week of Fox on Sports on Bedford 105.1, where I tried to change up the intro by saying good morning and then realized the show airs in the evening, too.
Yeah, that didn't work.
No, it was a miserable fail. So deleted and restarted. My name is Lauren Fox.
And I'm Andrew Hansen.
And for the next hour or so, we're going to wind up talking about baseball and basketball and golf and maybe golf. Yeah. There's some entertaining golf stuff going on. A little bit of tennis, a little bit of soccer. Some other Bedford stuff going on, so really just about anything that we can think of. Last night, if you happen to be at the Little League Complex, which I know you weren't, we were doing a little bit of scrimmaging. People might have had the opportunity to see me behind the plate umpiring for six innings in rainbow sandals.
Wow, how'd that go?
It was fine. The only time I was contacted by a ball was a hit batsman that glanced off his helmet and into my face mask. But yeah, I had said, yeah, I'll umpire. And then I forgot to bring shoes or contacts or anything that might help.
You didn't have contact lenses?
No, I had nothing. I had glasses behind the mask, but So six innings in rainbow sandals.
What's your style? Big zone, small zone?
Big zone. Okay. I want the kids to swing.
Okay.
That was really the excitement. The last few or the last 12 hours where people kept coming up and saying, I didn't realize you were in flip-flops the whole time. Would you expect anything less? We always, as we do, we'll check on Grant Levine and what is going on in the Pioneer League. I think the town of Bedford as a whole is spending way more time thinking about the Pioneer League this year than in the history of ever.
No doubt.
And it's because we have one of our own, Grant Levine, playing out there. His dad, Kevin, was gracious enough to bring me back a Grand Junction Rocky shirt.
the magical shirt that actually exists.
It is. It's a nice shirt. So, I would consider being their East Coast sales rep. It is a nice shirt.
Well, you showed me a picture.
Uh-huh.
And it's a fine picture. It looks like it could form the beginning of a great advertising campaign.
Yes. It is a nice shirt. It's a very Colorado shirt. So, but Grant is still doing well out there. He had a 10-game hitting streak snapped yesterday, but yeah, you can say that it was snapped because the guy didn't get any hits. But he was 0-for-2 with two strikeouts and earned his way to first base a couple times
by getting hit by a pitch two occasions.
Yeah,
took us some deep research to figure this out because
seriously,
we noticed that. He only had two official at-bats.
Right.
And he's the cleanup hitter.
That made no sense.
And after every single game having four or five plate appearances.
Right.
We were a little bit worried that he might have gotten injured.
And I'm sure he's a little bit sore this morning. He got hit by a couple pitches. But it finally took going to the Billings, Montana newspaper and seeing pictures and realizing that, wait a second, Grant was on base. It says he has two at-bats and two strikeouts, and there are only limited columns in the box that we were looking at.
And we thought maybe could it have been a sacrifice of some sort, which, of course, doesn't count as an at-bat.
Well, that makes no sense. I mean, it would have been a sack bunt that they ruled a sack bunt instead of a bunt single. But
And he didn't have any RBI, so it could not have been a sacrifice fly.
No. Well, no. And why would you get on base for that? Unless there's an error made by an outfielder, which, there you go, there's the second.
And we also mentioned that maybe he'd struck out and the ball had gotten past the catcher.
Yeah.
But that's not what happened.
No. Hit by two pitches yesterday. So he had been on a bit of a tear. He was at 475 in his last nine. Is that right?
That sounds about right.
That's what the Twitter told me. But so Grant doing well, making good solid contact, early returns on him from what Kevin has said too are very positive. So a lot of fun to watch this whole thing play itself out.
The numbers are strong to very strong.
Strong to quite strong.
He's batting .400 for the season.
Yep.
Four homers, 23 RBIs. He's got 26 hits in 17 games. Eight walks. He does have four stolen bases.
I also like the part where he has 23 runs batted in 17 games.
That's a strong ratio as well.
I feel like we're now like verging into territory of the guys on Saturday Night Live.
What territory is that?
The Bears.
Oh, yeah. The Bears.
Yeah, is Grant Levine driving the bus? Yes, then they win. So, but Ditka. Yeah, every week we'll give you the update on Grant.
Ditka versus Jordan. Yeah. Who wins?
Who wins? Ditka. Yeah, are they playing basketball? The interesting thing also is, you know, you're newer to town than I am, and I still feel like I'm new, even though I've been here the better part of 10 years. You remember, or I remember 2012 and 2015 and 2016. Little League teams won the state championship each of those years, and everywhere you would go, and I was loosely connected, if at all, with all three of those, just by virtue of the fact that I like baseball, I guess. And
you were umpiring back then, but not in sandals.
No, not in sandals. But everywhere you go, people want to talk about baseball. And Kevin brought it up the other day, Kevin Levine did, when we were talking. This really is a baseball town. Other towns report numbers dropping. Bedford sees numbers continuing to go up, and that doesn't even factor in the number of kids that are playing in some capacity year-round, travel ball, you name it, which form your own opinions about that. But the fun thing when you have a guy like Grant who's performing and has made somewhat of a name for himself, now I go places and people want to talk about what he's doing. I checked it this morning. I'm like, I didn't know. I never took you for a huge baseball fan, but I think it's the people like baseball, but they also like their own.
Absolutely.
And they like when their own do well.
It's sort of like the diehard Red Sox fans who are on top of all the prospects throughout the Red Sox system.
Yep.
And that kind of differentiates the casual fan with the hardcore fan. And it's fun to already be aware of a prospect as he's starting out.
Well, you feel like he's yours. It's like you bought stock in him without actually buying anything.
Right.
It's so speaking of the Red Sox last night, did you see Mookie Betts's, and we're recording this on Friday?
I did.
A grand slam on the 14th pitch
13th
of the at-bat?
13th pitch.
I just like the part where Alex Cora says, yeah, that at-bat really wasn't that long. Because he had in 2004, and they showed it on SportsCenter this morning, he had an 18-pitch at-bat. And it was, and they showed it in all of its splendor with Vin Scully doing the broadcasting. And there were a lot of, like, basically, I'm just wasting them. I'm just taking a hack and wasting your pitch and spitting on it. Or in baseball, they'll use more vulgar things to describe it. You know, pitcher throws a pitcher's pitch, you throw the bat out. All right, next one, I'm just going to hope that he makes a mistake and I pick it up out of his hand. And sure enough, Alex Cora, in his case, it was pitch number 18 of the at-bat. Pitcher made a mistake. Alex Cora hit it into the bullpen in right field in Dodger Stadium. So Alex Cora has some experience with long at-bats.
Yeah, I thought you were talking about a Betts at-bat. So that doesn't surprise me with Cora because he's known as a little bit of a slap hitter. And when you are that size and that is the role you play, you need to be able to foul off pitches, spoil pitches, extend at-bats. So it doesn't surprise me at all that he had an 18-pitch at-bat. What surprises me is that on the 18th pitch he had a home run.
Yeah, that's the shocker. That's the bigger shocker. Cora said yesterday that the pitch count that Mookie Betts hit the home run on yesterday was nothing.
What do you mean? Oh, 13 is just
13 compared to 18.
No big deal, yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, so he's kind of jokingly comparing himself to Betts and knowing that Betts is just an incredible hitter. And what was fun about it was his reaction. I mean, he was fired up. It was like a postseason game-winning home run, his reaction.
I really enjoy watching that guy play.
Oh, how can you not?
It's just, you look at him, and he's kind of a guy that he's been around, not for a long time, but he's been around. It seems like he's been around for longer than he has. He's only been in the major leagues for what? This is his fourth full year. So 2014 was the year that he broke in. But, like, all of a sudden, he's gone from a guy who, good player. I mean, he's been top 10 in the MVP voting each of the last 2 years to a transcendent player. And we get to watch it. And you look at this team that, with the exception of JD Martinez, basically, these guys are homegrown guys. So back to your point about prospects.
Yeah, it's exciting, and I saw this stat yesterday that they're now 37 games over 500. Just incredible, incredible season. And, you know, you talk about the strategy within an at-bat and your approach at the plate. And there was a really interesting article this week in ESPN by Jerry Krasnick about the shift in baseball.
Yes.
And it's become very widespread.
Before we get that far, I just want to note Mookie Betts has more home runs in the last three quarters of a season than Alex Cora had in his entire career.
There you go.
Okay, continue.
So it's become very prevalent in baseball, the shift, where especially against left-handed hitting, power-hitting batters, you'll have some variation of a shift where, you know.
We do it in softball.
Oh, yeah. You end up with somebody in short right field. You end up with maybe the third baseman up the middle. Maybe the third baseman's playing at shortstop, but you have the entire, some major portion of the left side of the infield is completely wide open.
It's bizarre. And the official ruling on it is, I mean, if you have the third baseman playing in right field, he's still five.
Right.
He's still the third baseman.
When you're scoring the game.
Yeah, so it makes scoring a game just bizarre.
Now, before we get into the strategy and what the hitters do, let's just talk about the debate that has been brewing, which is should Commissioner Manfred do something to legislate away the shift? Should they institute a rule that says something like you need two infielders on the right side of the infield and two infielders on the left side of the infield at all times? Would you be in favor of such legislation?
No, I think you shot me that article over, and Daniel Murphy really impressed me in that article. Murphy, the second baseman for the Washington Nationals when he's not hurt, but very good hitter. And as it turns out, he's a student of the game, obviously, was throwing out a lot of kind of high-level stats and threw something out at one point. He said, well, really, this isn't rocket science. And I go, dude, actually, it is rocket science. It's not rocket science to you, but it's rocket science. And his point, one of his points within that was when they originally started playing this game, they aligned players based upon where they thought people were going to hit the ball. So that's how you wound up with the configuration. The pitcher and the catcher, you really can't do a whole lot about. You need a guy to throw it, and you need a guy to catch it. The rest of the guys, they put them there for a reason. And all the shift is putting guys there for a reason. It's not like in the NFL, if you run out of a bizarre formation, but, for example, your wide receiver is going to the line before the ball is snapped, which is okay in the CFL but not in the NFL, you are gaining an advantage because your receiver has a head of steam as he's getting to the line. And there are legal shifts that can be made that have been legislated into the game for a reason. I don't see a reason why the weird shifting should be legislated out. If you make a shift and it works for you, great, do it. If you make a shift and it costs you, too bad, dude. That's your fault. I think it adds an additional layer of managing, and in some cases, like we talked about Gabe Kapler a few weeks ago, it adds a layer of overmanaging to it as well.
Oh, I think it would be awful if they legislated the shift out of baseball. I mean, it's all about strategy, to your point, offensively and defensively. It's a game of cat and mouse, and the manager of the defensive team is positioning his players where he thinks that particular hitter is most likely to hit the ball. And they're using data from hundreds, if not thousands of at-bats in that player's past with the spray chart to figure out where is he most likely to hit the ball. And it's just one of the fascinating things that has developed with this age of analytics is to see this shift and to see the managers gradually become more comfortable with this idea of, you know what, let's put a guy in short right field because, you know, David Ortiz, if he gets a, you know, he hits a lot of line drives right there. And if we put a guy there, not only are we going to wipe out his line drive single to right, but he's not that fast of a runner. If he hits a, you know, one or two hopper, we can even throw him out at first. So let's dare him to either bunt down the third baseline or try an inside out, a weak ground ball to left field. And if he can do that, then you just tip your cap to him and you give him a single. And the advantage is he's not, you know, trying to tee off for an extra base hit. So it's just, I think it's a wonderful piece of strategy that's developed that's fascinating.
It has changed the game. It's interesting. You know, some guys, they shift on a lot. Some guys get shifted on very infrequently. If you spray the ball, you're not likely to do it. If you're more of what I would call a punch and Judy hitter, who's singles, doubles guy, and can hit it to all fields, they'll play you straight away. But if you're a guy who's a dead pull guy, which a lot of you left-handed guys are, they are going to stack more fielders over there. Not to mention, somebody brought up a point in that article, is it more logical, okay, if do you technically win, like, in what's the outcome of the inning, do you win if Ortiz only has a single versus a home run? And do you win now if he's clogging up the bases? To Daniel Murphy's point, you know, it's going to take you three hits basically to score a run. Do you win in that instance if nobody's on base? You're just basically intentionally walking for all intents and purposes. You're intentionally walking David Ortiz. The other thing that's interesting, and it just goes to show how easy these guys make this look. And by these guys, I'm talking about professional athletes, and we've talked about some of the stuff these guys do that is just astonishing. But to say that these guys on a pitch that's 95 miles an hour with movement, that if you grabbed 100 people off the street and said, hit it, your contact rate would be abysmally low. Even if you took these people for a month and said, go take batting practice, you're saying to these guys, hey, first of all, you're making this look so easy. Why don't you just put it right over there? Hitting a round bat with a round ball, not an easy thing. The other thing is, it's not like they're facing little league pitching where the pitcher isn't quite certain where the ball is going. These guys have pinpoint control, most of them. I mean, and there are exceptions to every rule, and there are times that guys struggle with control. But if I know that my defense is all shifted over to the right side and I'm facing a left-handed hitter, there's no way I'm going to the outer half of the plate against that guy knowing that all he's got to do is just flip one down the line and he's got a double.
Right, or he can drive it into the gap for a double.
Yeah. It's the pieces where the players make this look, the execution so effortless that the rest of us say, well, why don't they just do this? Because it's not as easy as you think.
Yeah, and the three hitters that were interviewed in this article gave a lot of great points about that strategy, and they are Daniel Murphy, Kyle Seager, and Matt Carpenter, three lefties who drive the ball for a lot of extra base hits. And one thing Daniel Murphy said was, if he is going to try and do that, what do? You let the ball travel a little bit. You let the ball get deeper, and then you create that angle where on a pitch down the middle, you can hit it to the left side. And these top-level Major League Baseball hitters are good enough to control where they are hitting the ball to a certain extent.
Yes, but I can't, if a pitch isn't pitched away,
right,
it's difficult for me to hit that ball to right field unless I completely mess up.
Right.
And if, you know, and we work on it, we spent enough time working on this in the cage, me and Maggie. Okay, I'm pitching you away. You let the ball get deeper on you, and this is where I want you to hit it. I'm throwing you a curveball. I'm right-handed throwing you a curveball, and it's breaking that way. Hit it over there. Hit it over there. Hit it over there. The theory is always there. It's just a matter of, can you put that into practice? And you see it happen enough times, and you've done it, and I've done it, where somebody throws you a fastball away and you go, ah, it's great, I'm going to hit it, or a curveball away, great, I'm going to hit it, and you roll over on it and you hit it. If you're right-handed like me, hit it to the right side, you wind up rolling over and hit it to the right side. The what you're really requiring in order to adopt a strategy of, I'm just going to flip the ball on the left side, you're requiring that a pitcher is going to throw you a pitch that's conducive to that, and you're going to be able to make that decision within 0.6 of a second.
Yeah. At the major league level, it's very difficult because of the speed of the pitch and because you need a little help on the location. You know, it's funny, in like men's pitch softball, you can overcome both of those variables and hit the ball the other way if you want to every time, because the ball is in the air for so long that you have plenty of time to actually adjust physically.
You can move your feet.
You can move your feet. So it's a little bit different. The timing and you have the more time and the location because you can move. Because you have enough time to physically move, you can change the location. So you can turn an inside pitch into a pitch that's basically over the plate or on the outside of the plate. So you know, to Daniel Murphy's point, that makes it so that you can't just, it's so easy. Every time they put the shift on me, I'm just going to hit a ground ball to the left side. It is more difficult than you would think. But getting back to your point about rocket science, these guys made some really fascinating points in this article, you know, and a lot of it is based on data. Daniel Murphy talked about how the stats say that 7% of ground balls go for extra base hits. So how does that affect his strategy? He tries to hit the ball in the air. Because if he hits a line drive, he's more likely to get an extra base hit. If he hits a fly ball, he's more likely to get a home run. You know, if it's somewhere in between, then he's got a great chance at an extra base hit. But if he's just trying to slap it on the ground, he's probably not going to get an extra base hit. He might not even get a hit, especially if he's hitting it into the shift. So his whole mentality now is, I got to get the ball airborne, because what I'm trying to do every time I come to the plate is hit a double. And that's something I hadn't actually heard from a hitter, but that is what he's saying. His approach is, every time up to the plate, I'm trying to hit a double. So I'm trying to hit the ball in
right.
the air.
I'm trying to get 2 seconds. I thought that was cool.
If I miss it a little bit, I might hit a home run. You know, but if I do what I want to do, I have a chance at a double. I'm going to hit in the gap. And it's a complete miss if I hit a ground ball, because the chances of getting an extra base hit are not very high.
Yeah, it's kind of reminds me of when I play skee ball. I aim for the 20, knowing that if I miss a little bit, I get a 30 or 40. Like, I'm good. And that turns into a good game. The the other piece from that article, and Dana Murphy said it, level of production goes strikeout, pop-up, ground ball, fly ball, line drive, which is valid. You know, and somebody put that together who's far smarter than I am. But the strikeout piece, to me, is always a little more preferable to a pop-up, because there really is no chance for a double play on a pop-up. There is always that chance for some kind of a secondary out to exist. The other thing is, in this day and age of pitch counts, a strikeout is more preferable because it gets you closer to the point in time if you're getting dominated by a starter when they might give them the hook. But, yeah, both of those tend to qualify as a non-productive out. I mean, there was a point in time, I'm going to say 4 or 5 years ago, where the prevailing wisdom was the strikeout was better than a ground ball with guys on base, because it keeps you out of a double play. So, but the idea of line drives, and we've all heard it, home runs are mistakes, which they are. Those two things together kind of get you to why Daniel Murphy is as successful of a hitter as he is.
Yeah, and I just hope that the game plays out naturally with these strategies, and the baseball does not legislate a change, because I just think it's a slippery slope. I mean, where do you draw the line? At the end of the game, with the winning run on third, you're going to tell a team you can't have 5 infielders?
Right.
I mean, it's just...
Or you can't pull your outfield in? Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
What? Now outfielders have to be at a depth of at least 260 feet?
Yeah, special line. Yeah.
So, you just got to let it play out naturally.
It's like the Rock and Jock softball challenge. So, All-Star Game is Tuesday. Are you going to watch it?
Yeah.
And you're right-hand cool about it?
Well, absolutely. And so, here's the thing, because you asked me before the show, does anybody care about the Home Run Derby anymore, which is always on Monday, and the All-Star Game is always on Tuesday. And for someone who writes a haiku about a sporting event every day of the year, it matters a lot to me, because historically, the day before the All-Star Game and the day after the All-Star Game are the only 2 days in the calendar year where there isn't a major sporting event.
Right.
You don't have – basketball's over. Hockey's over. Golf tournaments are played Thursday to Sunday.
Right.
There's not going to be a World Cup game. So, you know, Wimbledon will be over. So there's no game. There's nothing to write about. You have to go to, like, a minor league baseball game to get content. But the Home Run Derby – takes care of one of those days. So now the Monday every year before the All-Star Game is the Home Run Derby, and that's what I've got to write about.
So what do you write about on Wednesday?
Wednesday is... Yeah. Right. How many awards does LeBron win at the ESPYs? Yeah. Or Danica Patrick hosting the show as a retired female race car driver. Fascinating, but this it's not an actual sporting event with competition, so I can't write about it. So it is, you got to go to, usually it's like a minor league baseball game. I think in 2012, when I wrote the book, it was a AAA game with the Aces involved.
It's funny. It's always nice when you get that day off, though.
For what?
Oh, when I used to handicap, it was nice because I had a day where I couldn't put any games up at all.
There you go.
And I was like, this is great. I can wake up in the morning and relax, and I don't have to worry about putting stuff up. So that was nice for those few years. The other thing, so going back to the All-Star game, I remember back in 1989. So that was almost 30 years ago now, so 29 years ago. It was 29 years ago.
Wait,
this
89?
Past Wednesday, yeah, when Bo Jackson led off for the American League with a home run against Rick Rueschel.
In the All-Star game.
In Anaheim Stadium, yep.
And where were you sitting?
We were there. I believe we were on the lower level, like behind the plate, reasonably high up, like covered seating. But, yeah.
Was Magic Johnson walking
Magic,
the aisles?
Magic was not there. But I was just thinking about the fact that, like, that 29 years ago, that's a long time.
Yeah.
But the All-Star game at that point, I mean, that was... They had the home run derby. They had the skills competition. Barry Larkin injured himself, might have pulled a hamstring in the skills competition. He missed a bunch of the second half of the season. I mean, you always get these weird things happen. And Bobby Abreu, remember that when he hit about 800 home runs in the home run derby and then hit about two the rest of the year?
Right.
I'm exaggerating.
Well, that's always the risk for the big sluggers.
Right.
Some of the guys don't want to do it again because they've seen how it has affected their own performance.
Which is crazy, though. It's 10 minutes of hitting.
But
it's intense.
It's just one of those things that happens.
Yeah.
I don't know the stats on it, but I'm sure somebody has tracked it. But yeah, in the old days, the All-Star game was more intense. All the big guys, Hank Aaron, who I think played in more than 20 All-Star games, they would typically play the entire game because it was a battle. And then it transitioned into the winner of the All-Star game earning home field advantage in the World Series.
Well, that was because they tied one year.
Right. So
ridiculous.
It has had varying amounts of intensity over the years. We don't have the home field advantage tied to it anymore.
Yes.
So it's a little bit different, and the guys don't play nine innings.
Yes.
You know, guys just want to get through without getting hurt, and some of the guys decide I don't even want to play, especially the pitchers.
Oh, Pete Rose, Ray Fosse. Look at that.
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean,
so
it's
changed
didn't
over
end
the years.
Ray Fosse's career, but he busted him up pretty good.
Yeah. So it's changed over the years, but it is still the collection of the greatest baseball talent in the world, so it's a lot of fun to watch.
It is a lot of fun to watch. I will be watching it. I'm always curious and the other thing that's hurt it, I think, is interleague play.
Yeah, because these guys, they see each other more often.
They see each other more. It used to be fun when you'd say, all right, this is a Seattle Mariners pitcher that is never going to see this Cincinnati Reds player, whatever.
Not to mention now we've had teams who have switched sides, like
yeah,
the Astros.
I was thinking
the
about
Brewers.
The Astros and the Brewers. You lose out on that piece, which has hurt it to a degree. Do you think there should be one player from every team?
Yeah, I'm fine with that. You know, expand the rosters. It's, you know, for the small, especially in baseball, where there is such a disparity with payroll, that for guys like us who over the years have cheered for teams like the Royals, who in most years aren't competitive.
This year being one of them.
To at least see one representative from the team in the world in the All-Star game, it's fun. It's a good tradition. I think it's positive.
Yeah, just, you know, I struggle with it this year because the Royals are horrible. Like, if you could relegate a team to the second division of major leagues, the Royals would be relegated to somewhere else. They'd be playing in the American Association or wherever. But Salvador Perez, who obviously we like him in our house, is hitting .217 and is an all-star. And Whit Merrifield is hitting .302 and is not an all-star. And you kind of go, how does, like, what?
It is certainly an imperfect
it's
system.
It's bad. It's gross. So, anyway, that's That's kind of my argument against a guy from every team. They should make a rule. If your team's winning percentage is below 400, you don't get anybody in the All-Star game.
Right. No, that'd be fair.
That'd be fair. If you're just that bad that you're unwatchable, which the Royals are completely unwatchable, like, there aren't even young players that you can look at and go, God, these guys are going to mature. It's like, how are they going to fix this? It's like, yeah, trying to patch holes in the Titanic.
Yeah, and to think they were in back-to-back World Series right. Just a few years ago.
Somebody else brought up that point last week, and I just laughed. Actually, it was my kid brought that up. But, yeah, it doesn't matter. That was a brief glimmer. Now they have not held on.
We might
on
have to wait another 30 years.
Oh, dude, longer than that. So, all right, we'll take a quick break, come right back. We'll talk about every other sport that we can think of, probably give a little bit of haiku, and I don't know. We'll come up with something. Back after this, you've been listening to Fox on Sports on Bedford 105.1. Welcome back to Fox on Sports on Bedford 105.1. Second half of the show coming, and the first half was all baseball all the time. The second half is going to be like the buffet, and that's making me hungry. The sports buffet for the next half an hour.
And as the appetizer,
yes,
what? During the break,
potato skins.
Lauren Fox just watched some soccer highlights.
Nachos. Oh, that was all just a trap. I want nachos now.
He has now seen some World Cup action.
Yeah, I'm bummed that I've missed it. Like, well, the last 2 weeks, what do? I wake up in the morning, I throw on SportsCenter, and then that transitions to Wimbledon.
Right.
And I just don't change a channel, and I forget when games are on. I mean, I have FS1. That's not the problem. I just, for whatever reason.
10 o'clock or 2 o'clock on the East Coast. That's when they're on.
There you go.
Keep now that in mind for 2022.
When it's, yeah.
Well, depending on where that World Cup is played that year. I don't know.
It's in Qatar.
Okay.
Or Qatar, or however you would like to pronounce it, given your various need to impress somebody by pronouncing a country's name. But yeah.
Well, for
I was listening to a segment on NPR the other day. I heard it pronounced five different ways. I'm like,
yep.
Okay. I still don't know.
And for me, the focus on pronunciation is not to impress. It's to just know how many syllables there are in the word.
Yes.
Because with 575 in haiku, you need to have a comfortable feel about how many syllables there are to be able to count to five
right.
or seven or to five. And that came into play with a haiku I wrote on the France-Belgium match, semifinal match, that I want to get into.
I knew that's where we were going.
So yes. Here we go. Adjacent bodies converge in semifinal, elevate for ball. Abutting nations, header-header summit, splash. Umtiti felly. Umtiti dances. Kisses his jersey's rooster beneath single star.
You take that eight-letter name, and it's Felly?
Well, that's his nickname.
But okay.
Here's how we're going to get there. So, you've now seen the highlight.
Right.
The ball is in the air on a corner kick.
He looks like a guy I used to work with, and I don't know how to say either of his names. Marouane Fellaini?
No. Nice try, though. All right, so here's what we've got. We've got Umtiti of France and this other guy with long hair for Belgium up in the air for a header. And the first thing that was interesting about the play is it's a goal for France. It's the only goal of the match. They win 1-0 in the World Cup semifinals to go advance to the finals. Titi gets credit for the goal, but it deflected off the Belgium player's head as well.
Yes.
However,
yes.
Yeah. If you look at the replay, it's a slight deflection off the French player's head,
yes.
Then a bigger deflection off the Belgian player's head, and it quickly goes in the goal. The Belgian goalkeeper had really no chance to stop it.
Right now.
But during the broadcast, they didn't notice it. They didn't discuss it on replay. And in the one-hour highlight show
on Fox every
night.
I can't believe you watched all this.
Well, this is what you have to do. In the one-hour highlight show on Fox, I didn't hear them mention it either, which I think is somewhat noteworthy that, you know, I guess it wouldn't be considered an own goal, but it deflected off the defender and they didn't even mention it. Well, anyway, it got me thinking that to describe this play, I've got to mention the Belgian defender and I need to know how many syllables he has in his name to write this haiku. So it occurred to me, all right, how do I figure out how to pronounce this guy's name? Now, the first place I went to was the game broadcast replay. And when I listened to the play again, the game broadcaster pronounced it as...
Fellini.
Do it again.
Wait.
Mahlon Fellini.
That's not my voice.
So where are you on YouTube?
Yes.
And it sounds like Fellini, correct?
Mahlon Fellini.
Mahlon Fellini.
So that's not the...
Does it say Laurel or Yanny?
That's not the first place I went. The first place I went was the game broadcast.
Yep.
And he pronounced it as Fellini.
Yeah.
Okay. Then I go... So I'm thinking, all right, three syllables. Then I go to the highlight show. And in the highlight show, the guy who's describing the play says Fellini. Fellaini. So he
added a syllable.
He added a syllable.
He put the emphasis on the wrong syllable.
He goes from Fellaini to Fellaini. So he goes from three syllables to four. And he sounds like he has a European accent. He's supposed to
credible.
Know.
Yes.
Immediately credible.
Yes.
But he just went from three syllables to four. So now, yes, I'm left absolutely clueless. So then where do I go? I go to Wikipedia. I pull up this guy's name on Wikipedia.
Wikipedia usually has a pronunciation.
It doesn't.
Nothing.
For him, it has nothing.
Seriously.
So now where do I go? I do what you just did. I type the guy's name into Google, and I say pronunciation of his name, and these generic YouTube pronunciations come up where you listen to how they think it should be pronounced, and you're not sure if it's right or not. But from what you just played, there were three syllables. So I'm thinking, all right.
Mahlon Fellini.
Sounds like it's three syllables. Then another thing that comes up on Google with this guy is a video clip of some other announcer having trouble pronouncing his name. He keeps trying to pronounce it and he can't even get it out. He doesn't know how to say it.
Right.
So then I go to the team website that this guy plays on for his club team, and I see an article on him, and it says that all of his teammates call him Felly. That's his nickname.
Even better.
So now I have my solution. I don't need to figure out if it's three or four for his real name. I'm just going to go with his nickname, Felly, which is Felly.
Two syllables. Done.
Done.
I would have figured you might have been able to work some Albert Camus in there somewhere, but no, there was none.
Why Camus? Was he the French writer?
A French writer, Moroccan soccer player who lives in Belgium. Like, work all that stuff in, but no.
No Camus.
That might have some next level stuff right there.
But that's Felly. That's how we get to Felly. His Belgian side is done, though, because after that ball went off his head, they lost 1-0. And so now it's France and Croatia Sunday.
Yes.
If you're listening to us on Saturday, that's tomorrow.
Sunday.
Big deal. Every 4 years, we got the World Cup going up against the men's singles final in Wimbledon.
Yes. And no Roger Federer in that one, which was utterly shocking. Kevin Anderson coming seemingly out of nowhere. It was like I watched the first two sets and said, I don't need to watch anymore.
Exactly.
I'm good. I mean, I will passively watch this stuff, so I'm working, but the TV is on in the background. I love Wimbledon simply because they're 5 hours ahead, so it just rolls right into some sort of activity that I can passively watch. I hear the announcers. If there's something amazing that's happening, I hear it, and I can lock in on it for a minute, and then I'm gone again. And it's not something that has a predetermined outcome. Because watching a TV show and attempting to work is impossible. This tennis and baseball are the two perfect things to watch because you can really just passively
soccer's not bad
watch
either.
Maybe so. Now you tell me. but so Wimbledon's great for that. Well, two sets in, I'm like, all right, I'm done. I don't need to pay attention anymore.
It's Federer in a major,
yeah,
up two sets to love. It's over.
Yeah, it was done.
And he hadn't been broken on his serve in over 80 straight games.
I brought that up. It was, I think, 36 games when I brought it up earlier in the tournament. Was just sitting there watching it, and they mentioned it, and I regurgitated that to somebody else, and you just go, this is insane. And then all of a sudden, it went from bad to worse pretty quickly for Federer. And there was some really good tennis being played there, though, with his match with Anderson, Del Potro and Nadal going against each other. I'm curious to see what happens. The semis are today.
They're happening as we speak.
It just blows my mind too. There's an American in the semifinals, and nobody knows it.
Isner.
Yeah, John Isner's there.
Well, if you tune in. Either right now as we're talking, so before the airs.
Before the show airs, or, good luck to you.
Or if he prevails, which it looks like he probably will. He's up two sets to one.
He's up two sets to one. He's going to be in the final going against the Joker or Nadal.
Right. And it's going to be entertaining because Isner is 6'10". He's the tallest tennis player ever in a major semifinal. He hits serves upwards of 140 miles an hour. And he has now won over 100 straight service games at Wimbledon. He has not been broken in this entire tournament. And the match right now with Anderson is everything in tiebreaks. Isner lost the first one in a tiebreak, but he's won the last two, 7-6. 7-6, they're even in the fourth 2-all as we speak. So it appears that he has still not been broken. It's just amazing to watch him serve.
Yeah, he is not an insignificant human being. At 6'10", and he's not a young one either. I mean, I remember it had to be 7 years ago or so when he played in the longest match in Wimbledon history. It was Wimbledon.
That's right.
And it spanned over 2 days. It's memory serves it was the better part of 6 hours. So I mean, he's been around the block,
and that's what he's been known for.
Yeah.
Up until now.
Yeah. So.
But. It got me thinking this morning. I actually had a little breakfast at Wimbledon, and my mom was asking.
That was 2010.
Oh, was it? Okay.
Yeah.
So she was asking, how fast are these guys serving? And so we started looking, and as I mentioned, you know, I think the hardest one I saw him hit today was 139.
Yeah.
But then I pulled up an article that said that the fastest serve ever at Wimbledon was last year against Federer's 152.
Woo!
So I got to thinking, what do you have more reaction time to do? Return a serve like that or hit a 95 mile an hour fastball?
What's the answer?
I think you have slightly more time to return the serve.
Okay.
And I found a lot of articles about the topic, none that actually had the actual reaction time required. So they had the baseball as between 0.35 and 0.4 seconds from the release of the pitch until when you have to hit it. But they didn't have it calculated for tennis for some reason. But what I did find was a video from the New York Times where they analyzed, first of all, what a 150-mile-an-hour serve looks like if it's coming at you. So if you pull up that video, it's really fun to see. It's just on you immediately.
Yeah.
And they calculated the thing about the tennis serve that you might not know is if it starts out at 150, that's the velocity as it leaves the racket. And in this simulation, the New York Times calculated that right before it hits the ground on the other side of the net, it's already down to 103. Then right after the bounce, it's down to 85 miles an hour.
Okay.
Due to friction, air, you know, variables, all that stuff, you know, physics. By the time it gets to the baseline where you're going to hit it, it's all the way down to 73 miles an hour. So as it's in your hitting zone, it's actually easier to hit a tennis ball because it's going much slower than the 95-mile-an-hour fastball.
Slight problem, though. Your brain can't pick up anything within that last 15 feet. So you have to practice enough that you're able to watch the ball hit the ground, perform a very quick calculation on the deceleration of the tennis ball in order to hit it. So the answer to your question, from the release of the pitch until it gets to the plate, a 95-mile-an-hour fastball, the reaction time is 450 milliseconds, so 0.45. For a tennis serve, an average first serve in the men's 2011 U.S. Open was 113.1 miles an hour, which gave opponents 0.47 seconds to react to a tennis ball. So the difference is insignificant.
Very, very similar reaction time.
Very similar. The current world record serve speed for men is 163.7 miles an hour, which brings Sam Groth's, whoever that is, I should know who he is, but I don't, opponent's necessary reaction time down to 0.325 seconds.
So Groth was the guy who I believe last year hit 152 in Wimbledon. So maybe he hit that 163 in some other tournament, but the article I read was about the fastest serve at Wimbledon. So if it ends up being about the same reaction time, of course, the difference in baseball is you have a much skinnier surface that you're trying to hit the ball with a bat versus the bigger tennis racket. But fun to compare. And, you know, you see a lot of comments on various websites about whichever sport you're used to, you know, thinking that's more difficult. And the thing about tennis that's different, that gives it a more challenging element, is that the ball starts up very high, goes all the way to the ground, and then bounces back up. And as you're talking about, it's hard to make adjustments at the very end of it. But that's a lot different than baseball because, you know, the pitch is just coming on one plane. It doesn't bounce off the ground. And so I just found some of these stats interesting that for Isner, who's 6'10",
yes,
the average contact height for him where he's hitting the ball on his serve is 10 feet 1 inches in the air. Then it goes all the way down to the ground and bounces back up. So it's just a different angle that is involved in hitting the tennis ball. And, you know, baseball doesn't have that change in angle, but obviously it has a lot of movement on the pitch.
Yep.
And I think most would agree, if they're being impartial, that as you've heard the old adage, the hardest thing to do in sports is to hit a baseball.
Yeah.
So that's what I think is a little bit harder. But you don't have much time in tennis. It's not easy.
So interesting fact, too, about tennis, because I got asked this question in my house earlier. Why don't the men and women play together? And wouldn't it be fun if at the end of the tournament, the top woman and the top man faced off? You go back to the Bobby Riggs and Billie Jean King thing from
Battle of the Century
45 years ago or so. And Bobby Riggs, who was washed up at that point, basically wiped the floor with Billie Jean King. I will say that women players have improved in probably comparison to the 1973 women's player. The 2018 women's player is better than, like, if you were to say, okay, this is the level of play 1973 to 2018, how much have the men improved? How much have the women improved? The women have improved at a greater rate than the men have.
So, like, Navratilova versus Serena Williams, who wins?
Serena would destroy her.
Right.
Destroy her.
Yep.
Which, I mean, that's another conversation, too. You know me. I have my favorites that I like to watch. And regardless of any other thing about them on the field or on the court or you name it, there are just some people whose level of fitness and determination and preparation and passion just puts them on some bizarre pedestal. And Serena Williams is that.
She's incredible.
She is out of this world. And to do what she has done so quickly after having a little one, it's just nuts.
Yeah.
I mean, the only one I compare to her is your wife.
Well, yeah. Yep. I mean, to run a marathon, you know, when you're pregnant, or to run a 50-mile race, whether you're pregnant or not,
yeah,
is phenomenal.
I just said that to set you up. But just you look at what Serena's done. There is very little variation. You know, you look at the top servers, yeah. But there's not as much variation as you'd think between the average top male service speed and the average top female service speed. You know, if it were a game of serving for speed, it would be a lot closer than you think. There are going to be other things that I'm sure would tip the scales, but would I be curious to see how Serena would perform? Absolutely. Because, yeah, you can't take competitiveness away.
No.
Like,
no. And she's high on that
variable.
She'd
be going for somebody. So, I don't know. So Wimbledon has been nothing short of entertaining from what we've seen. Did you catch the thing, speaking of country club sports, did you see on SportsCenter they're talking about golf today, the burrowing animal?
No, I didn't see that.
Did you not see that? So Zach Johnson was trying to get a drop or get relief from where he was, and there were anthills, and he was basically inquiring, was a fire ant a burrowing animal? So that he could get relief from it. And as it turns out, with the burrowing animal rule, insects are not burrowing animals. Insects are insects. You get no relief.
Oh, I would beg to differ on that particular animal, because I don't know if I've ever told you this story, but one of the most memorable road trips that I ever had playing baseball down in the South was in Louisiana. And I woke up in the middle of the night in some, you know, we could call it a cheap hotel. It was not a five-star hotel. It was on the road in a small town in Louisiana. And that's where we were staying, at least two to a room. You know, you got to cut costs as a minor league team, independent league team. And middle of the night, I'm just itching my neck a lot. And then the next, I had a lot of trouble sleeping. I usually sleep like a baby. Wake up the next day, look in the mirror, and I've got this entire swath of my neck that's completely red with these huge bumps. Basically, I was attacked by fire ants in the middle of the night.
Dirt in your neck.
Oh, my gosh. They were burrowing into my neck for sure. So I think if there's a term called a burrowing animal, I think the fire ants should qualify.
Fire ants are burrowing animals? Is that what we've decided?
That's what we've decided.
So, bizarre in the world of golf. And ultimately, they said you got to hit your shot from where it is. And then his playing partner went to go and give him relief because I guess there were stakes and flags. And it's what you got to look it up. And if anybody's still listening to the show, they can look it up too. His playing partner goes and tries to get the stake out of the ground and basically just pulls it back and forth and then throws up his hands and walks away. And then one of the course guys just comes up and just picks up a stake straight up like you would pick up a stake and lays it down on the ground. And
yeah, it's funny. When you do a drop in golf, you have to go through a lot of histrionics.
Yeah, it's bizarre.
You got to put tees down, measure a club length, make sure you don't drop it any closer to the hole, make sure it doesn't roll too far after you drop it. But I haven't seen a video where they had trouble just getting a stake out of the ground.
Yeah, no, it was pretty funny. It was pretty funny. So, you will, by the time this show airs, be able to, you may have a line on what Serena did in the finals. Who knows? And then the other piece is the Wimbledon men's final will be set and will take place on Sunday, a little breakfast at Wimbledon. I'm going to have strawberries and cream at home.
You should.
No, I won't.
And actually, it, as you're sitting there, and, you know, if it's Saturday morning and you're listening to this while Serena is playing.
Oh, dude.
And you're hearing us and watching, and you're sort of thinking about this baseball versus tennis thing, I just want to throw in one more stat.
Yes, go.
Because I know I was curious about it, is, well, how far away is the tennis player?
Yes.
Because in baseball, of course, it's 60 feet, 6 inches from the rubber to home plate. Well, it turns out in tennis, it's actually 60 feet from the baseline to the back of the service line where the ball has to be in that box. So the back of that box is the service line. So it's actually 60 feet. It's a little bit closer. But, of course, the player who's returning it is back behind the baseline. The baseline to baseline is 78 feet.
Yep.
And most professional tennis players are standing several feet behind that as they wait to return the first serve. So in tennis, it ends up being that you've got about 80 to 85 feet to react.
Yep.
Of course, in baseball, you have 60. So that's the other calculation that you have to do, is you have a bigger physical distance for that 130-150 mile an hour serve to travel.
There's a lot that has to happen awfully quickly for you to be able to return a serve in tennis.
Yeah. Yeah.
And again, it's the amount of preparation that it requires, the amount of practice and just mental training. And, you know, you have major league players do it where they throw tennis balls and pitching machines that have a number, and the guys have to attempt to call out the number or the color, or like, it's just, it's training, and it's training your eyes and training your brain to be able to deal with any of that sort of stuff. And the more that you watch, and you watch guys as they go, guys and girls, as they go through various checkpoints of, okay, it's little league, it's high school, it's college. And I had touched on this a little bit. The gradations get so fine on what makes somebody good versus very good versus great versus elite. Whether it's fielding, whether it's a tiny piece of footwork that a guy might or might not do, that the casual fan, I'll include myself in that, might not pick up on. You might pick up on it because you've seen it, been trained on something at a higher level. But what scouts are picking up on and what front office staff are picking up on, the amount of work, and it's not just idle work on broad things, the amount of work and the amount of kind of fine-tuning that goes into making these athletes what they are and the amount of fine-tuning that's required of them to get them to that level is insane.
And one thing about it is once you learn the technique to become elite and you practice it thousands and thousands of hours, hundreds of thousands of times, I think you internalize it, sort of like riding a bike. You master the fundamentals to such a level that it becomes second nature. And for different people, it's different. You know, for me, it's shooting a free throw. For other people, it's, you know, hitting a 7-iron because they've done it so many times that they're just, it's automatic. And
there is a time that it becomes automatic, yes.
Right. And so when you made the transition from tennis to golf a minute ago, it reminded me of this other fun story I heard about this week. Did you hear about this 79-year-old former professional golfer, this woman, Joanne Carner?
Oh, yeah, of course. I know who she is.
Okay. Yeah?
Yeah, but I don't know anything about what happened this week. Well, I haven't thought about that name in 30 years.
I don't think I've ever heard of her, but she was terrific. She's in the Hall of Fame.
Oh, yeah.
She is the only woman to have won the U.S. Girls Junior, the U.S. Women's Amateur, and the U.S. Women's Open titles. So basically, she's the Tiger Woods of women's golf, you know, to some degree. She's 79 years old. She just participated in the U.S. Senior Women's Open this week, and she shot her age, 79.
I love that.
79-year-old shot a 79. That's impressive.
Yeah, she was big back. She was like the rival of Nancy Lopez.
Okay, well, see, you're a lot older than me, so yeah. you would know her. But that is, I think, a perfect example of somebody who just has mastered the game to such a level that can come out and shoot 79 because she's not going to make any mistakes. She's just going to hit it in reliable spots. She knows how to play smart. And, you know, maybe if she plays for a couple weeks to get her short game up to par, no pun intended, then she can go out and do this. And I just think it's a fun story.
So, yes, she and Nancy Lopez, Donica Pony, there's another one. She's an analyst, but yeah, so it's I think the rest of us in just the older I get, the more appreciation I have for the amount of focus that goes into any of this. And the fact that if you don't start with the appropriate building blocks, like if your fundamentals are off and you're building on the wrong things, you will never become elite. If you have to, there are times that you can break it down and start from scratch. Tiger Woods notably has done that a handful of times with his swing. But if you're going to do that, you better be prepared with the amount of time that it's going to take you to get it done and the amount of heartache and mentally how resilient you're going to have to be to deal with the fact that you're not going to be you in that sphere of your life for a long time. So it's, I don't know, the mental side. And I guess while I'm thinking of the mental side, I want to take a moment to pay tribute to Ken Revizza, who is or was a well-known sports psychiatrist on the Southern California scene. Did I mention him last week?
Did I talk
about this at all?
No.
So a few weeks ago, I was, you know, my dad sent me an article from the Wall Street Journal. Ken Revizza was mentioned in it. He was the sports psychiatrist for the Cubs, and he had followed Joe Maddon around. So Maddon was with the Angels as like a minor league coordinator and he was with them forever, but it's almost like he's a Forrest Gump type guy of baseball. Like there are a lot of guys who, because of his time in the game, have been touched by Ken Revizza and by his theories and the things that he does to help athletes prepare mentally. Because that's one of the hardest, particularly with baseball, that's one of the hardest things is dealing with failure. And whether you're a kid or an adult, how do you deal with the fact that that last at bat or that last pitch didn't go how you wanted it to? How can you move on to the next one? And so Revisa, I used to get dragged by my dad when I was a kid to go and hear him speak, and went a handful of times. And I don't, you know, you process some pieces, but it's one of those when the pupil is ready, that the teacher is able, or the quote that I just completely bricked. you know, you take some pieces, but you don't get the full breadth of it. And so my dad sends me this Wall Street Journal article, and I went on and bought the video series that Ken Revisa had. And a great series, worth watching. Old athletes, young athletes, just it's a perspective of how to be a good hitter, be a good teammate, and clear your brain so that the next time up you can perform. Or when the wheels fall off, how do you get back on track as quickly as you can? Well, he suffered a stroke earlier this week, passed away at the age of 70. Justin Turner had a great memorial to him. Justin Turner, the third baseman for the Dodgers, who is not a household name out here, but Turner had played on a Cal State Fullerton team in 2004 that won the College World Series. And to a man, every guy on that roster was saying, we wouldn't have won this College World Series if it wasn't for Kenny. So kind of it's a neat thing, and you hope that he has the effect that a lot of artists have, where he passes away, and upon passing away, he becomes more well-known, because there is so much, even if you watch a 30-minute hitting video from him and you will never pick up a bat the rest of your life, it will apply to something in your life.
Yeah, well, I can still remember as a kid reading that famous book, The Mental Side of Baseball, The Mental Game of Baseball, and it's important. I mean, we talked about it with Chris Carpenter last week. How do you rebound from a bad outing?
Yeah.
And I've decided that I'm going to take his lesson and apply it to my golf game, which is after a so-so round or a bad round, I'm not just going to get all upset. I'm just going to say, hey, it's just part of the process. As I'm trying to lower my handicap, you know, I'm just going to say, hey, that wasn't my best day, but I'm just going to go hole by hole the next round. And if I have a double or triple bogey, just push it aside. I'm just going to go to the next hole.
Yeah, Kenny's thing is, so what, next, whatever. Next shot, next test, next presentation. You want to prepare as well as you can, to succeed as well as you can in that, but there's nothing you can do to fix anything that has already happened.
It's gone.
You can only fix where you are right now and the future. So with that said, so what? Next show.
Right.
I'd like to thank everybody here at Bedford 105.1. I'd like to thank our guests, or not, as well as the crew here at 105.1, Chris Gentry, who peeked his head in, Bill Jennings, Harry Kozlowski, and Colleen Richardson. Thanks for letting us invade your studio for an hour. It has been a pleasure as always. Enjoy a great sports week. Enjoy the Major League Baseball All-Star Game. And a shameless plug, our friends down at the Nashua Silver Knights are hosting the Futures League All-Star Game Tuesday night down in Nashua. So if you're looking for some good baseball, go see them this coming Tuesday night. For Andrew Hansen, I'm Lauren Fox. Have a great sports week. You've been listening to Fox on Sports on Bedford 105.1.